So I let you introduce yourself. I just say, well, I just say that we have César González Pérez from the Institute of Heritage Science at the Spanish National Research Council. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Emilio and Xavier, for inviting me. I'll try to be brief. Well, basically today I want to tell you about the approach that we've been following at INCIPIT about ontologies of cultural heritage. And in particular, I want to emphasize the connection between ontologies for humans and ontologies for machines. And I'm going to use the cultural heritage abstract reference model as an example to illustrate my points. So basically, when we think about ontologies, we usually think, especially in the field of in humanistic fields, we think of semantic web, of thesauri, control vocabularies, terminology, and especially W3C standards such as RDFS or SCOS or RAL. But if we look a bit into the literature, there are two different fields that have been dealing with these problems for a long time, for at least a few decades. On the one hand, artificial intelligence, on the other hand, software engineering. And both of these fields have been trying to solve the same kind of problem, that is how to represent the world, but with different, very different foci. So from artificial intelligence, we've been focusing on how reasoning occurs, and the previous speaker gave a very good example of how to deal with these issues about reasoning on information. However, on the software engineering side of things, people have been more concerned about how the world really is rather than how we reason about it. Again, from the artificial intelligence field, people have been worrying about artificially processing data, especially having the machine do that in a very formal way. However, on the software engineering field, people have been concerned with clear communication between people and people-oriented models and techniques. So these two trends, these two different fields have been basically approached the same problem with very different techniques and with different goals. However, in very recent times, trends are such that these two different approaches should not be that different, are not really that different. And it has been shown by different authors that ontologies in the artificial intelligence tradition are not that different from the conceptual models that people in the software engineering field have been using. And we gain a lot by combining strengths from both artificial intelligence and software engineering. And this is precisely the approach that we take at INCIPIT. We like to approach the representation of the world, especially of the heritage world, from a very hybrid perspective. So basically, the very key concept that we deal with when we think about ontologies or conceptual models, I'm going to use these two terms as almost synonyms. Ontology pertains to the artificial intelligence field, conceptual model comes from the software engineering field, but they are almost the same thing. So basically, we try to represent the world, and we conceive the world, as the previous speakers have shown, in terms of what categories there are, what entities there are, what properties or characteristics these entities and categories have, and what kind of relationships exist between them. And we represent these things in an ontology or a conceptual model through different things, through classes to represent categories, objects to represent entities, attributes, values, etc. So we have a collection of building primitives or primitive building elements that we can employ to represent the world. And when we do this, something very interesting happens. We have a representation relationship going on here. So an ontology or a conceptual model represents the world. And this may seem like a very obvious and non-interesting thing to say, but it is. When we think about how conceptual models or ontologies represent the world, we can see that representation implies three different things. First of all, they reproduce some part of the world. So when we represent, for instance, the room I'm sitting in or the computer I'm working with, or this conference we are attending, we are reproducing that. There is a relationship, a homology, if you want, between the things in the world and the things in the model. Secondly, when we do this, we are simplifying the world. So we are removing some detail and keeping some other kind of detail. And we have to decide what we discard and what we keep. And third, and most important, we can reason on the model or the ontology and apply the conclusions back to the world. And this is a very interesting point. So reasoning on the model is one part of the equation, and that is very good. But the most important thing is that we can apply the conclusions of that reasoning back to the real physical world. For instance, when we look at a map is a representation of the world. It's kind of a model, right? We can measure distances or do some kind of spatial computations on a map, but then we can apply those conclusions back to the physical world. And if I find an optimal route on a map, for instance, I can then apply that route to the world, and it usually works if the computation is properly done. So this representation phenomenon that goes on here is interesting because, as I said very briefly, reproduces some part of the world, simplifies it, and allows us to reason on the model and then apply the conclusions back to the world. Okay. So let me go back to the semantics, right? And this morning we have been hearing a lot about semantics and what they are. Usually when we deal with semantics, we start by looking at the world that surrounds us, and we perceive that world. We perceive the world in terms of some entities. We internalize that, we conceptualize that those entities into our mind, and then we can, if we want, we can formalize that using some kind of formal language. That this can be an ontology language, a formal language, a description logic, whatever kind of formal language that allows us to formalize that those informal concepts into our mind. And of course, we can depict the result of that. We can draw that into a picture in a page or on a screen, or we can in any manner or fashion depict that into some kind of external media to share it with other people. So what about semantics? Well, the model, the ontology of the conceptual model is this I'm pointing at. And it is in our heads. So the models are not external artifacts that live on paper or on a computer. The model lives in our heads, right? What lives outside our head can be a depiction of the model, can be some kind of formal representation, but in principle, the model lives in our head. And the semantics precisely are the relationships between this model and the physical world. So these connections between the elements in the model and the entities they refer to is what we call semantics. I'm emphasizing this because semantic technologies, despite their name, are often very very terminology-oriented. They focus a lot on the words and the phrases we use to describe things, and sometimes they are not that strong on connecting those words and terms to the actual world. Okay. In this context, I'm going to propose a few best practices that we have been using and that we recommend to deal with semantics and ontologies and conceptual models. The first one has already been mentioned by my colleagues before me this morning, and is that we should express our ontologies or models in a very well-defined language. We use CONML, but you can use other languages as well. As long as they are well-defined, their semantics are precise, they are well-known and documented. Secondly, we need to modularize concerns. When we describe an aspect of the world, there are things that are more abstract, others are more concrete, others are very specific to the domain, and some others are very generic. For instance, if I try to describe this room, I'm going to describe the desk I'm sitting at, the computer in front of me, but I'm also going to need to describe the colors of things, the materials that they are made of, etc. Things like computers or desks or chairs are perhaps a particular of a specific field of the world, but things like colors or materials are more general. And we need to modularize that. We need to separate concerns, as we say in software engineering, so that our ontologies or models are reusable and are well engineered. As a consequence of this, or as a refinement of this, we need to deal with cross-cutting aspects properly. And for instance, I think somebody asked before in the first talk this morning about time. And time or temporality, how things change over time, is what we call a cross-cutting concern. It is something that appears every time, no matter what kind of domain we work with. It doesn't matter whether we are dealing with cultural heritage or genomics or whatever. We always need to deal with time passage. We need to model how things change over time. There are some other cross-cutting concerns, such as subjectivity. So what different people think about the same thing, or vagueness, or uncertainty. So all these aspects should be dealt with in a spectral manner, in a cross-cutting manner. Then we should avoid implementation noise. That is, when we're trying to construct a model, we need to focus on the domain we're looking at, rather than on computer artifacts that we need perhaps to represent that domain. So when an analyst is trying to describe an archaeological site, for instance, they should be worried about the pottery and the features and the landscape and the people working there, rather than on ontology namespaces or URIs, because these are implementation noise. They are necessary, but they are a necessary evil. They are not part of the domain. Then I think we should focus on people first and then on machines. So a model needs to be understandable by people, no matter how well machines can reason on it. If people don't understand it, we are not really doing things well. But of course, we also need to think about machines. We need to make the models understandable by machines and computable by machines. Otherwise, we are not adding very much. Finally, we need to manage instantiation levels. And what I mean is that before I said, and some of my colleagues also mentioned, that we can represent the world, usually we represent the world in terms of categories and entities, or types and objects, if you want. So we usually establish this dual instantiation hierarchy. Sometimes it's deeper than two, sometimes we have higher order types, but in any case, we need to deal with different instantiation levels. And we need to manage this. We need to cater for the differences. And finally, we need to use tools. My colleagues have also mentioned different kinds of tools, and I'm going to talk about tools as well. Without specific tools that implement our languages, it's very difficult to extract information and to really obtain good results when working with ontologies. Right, so let me talk about charm for a moment. Charm is, I'm going to illustrate everything I've been saying through charm. Charm is an ontology of cultural heritage, or so to speak. We call it the Cultural Heritage Abstract Reference Model. It's composed of over 200 classes and a few attributes and associations. There is an underpinning theory of cultural heritage that tells us why charm is the way it is. But basically, it deals with different kinds of things, such as structures, objects, documents, agents, places, valorizations, representations, and other things. It covers more or less everything we need to deal with cultural heritage phenomena. Under the hood, charm is expressed in CONEMEL. So it's expressed in a well-defined and documented language. It's being constructed using a tool set, BUNT, that I will mention a bit later too. And it deals with cross-cutting aspects, as I mentioned before. In charm, we can deal with temporality in a cross-cutting manner, things like subjectivity, ontological and epistemic vagueness, multilingualism, and other aspects. Very importantly, too, charm is extensible, but more important even is that the extensions, when we customize charm to suit our needs, the extensions can be formally guaranteed to comply with the charm model. And this is very important, because sometimes in the literature, extension is meant to be any kind of change to a base model. And this is very good, but if we can't guarantee that the extension conforms to the previous model, then the extension is not really an extension, it's just a variant of the model, and we lose all of functionality. This allows us to do what we call gradual refinement of models that I will come back to in my last slides. So the overall structure of CHARM is composed, first of all, of what we call valuable entities. And a valuable entity is something that can receive or has received cultural value. So almost anything in the world can be a valuable entity. It can be physical or immaterial. It can be of any kind. Then we have valorizations. And valorizations are precisely the discourses or the narratives that provide cultural value to the valuable entities. And this, again, can be of many different kinds. They can be issued by an expert or can be issued by a regular citizen. And in any way, they are valorizations. And then we have representations, which, as the name indicates, represent both valuable entities and valorizations. Okay, let me dig in a little bit. Valuable entities can be of two kinds, primary or derived, and basically they have received or may receive, as I said before, cultural value, always granted by agents. So there's always some kind of agent, an individual or a big group, that grants some value on the valuable entities. Valorizations provide cultural value through argumentation, and we build this value through by arguing about valuable entities. So CHARM is very much linked to the argumentation and the discourse that creates this cultural value. And representations, lastly, depict and simplify other things, either valuable entities or valorizations. Right. I'm going to go very quickly through some examples of what kind of valuable entities we have in CHARM. So we deal with tangible things like structures, for instance, buildings, objects such as little artifacts or any kind of movable object. We also deal with stratigraphic elements, with samples, with places in the space, etc. We also deal with performative entities such as social acts or what we call expressive designs, so these ways of communicating through either language or sound or gestures or shapes or forms, right? And all the manifestations that happen in association to these performative entities. We also deal with abstract entities such as category systems or the argumentations themselves that create value, as I mentioned before. We also deal with beliefs or norms that people use and apply. Of course, we also deal with the people themselves, with agents, either individuals or groups or roles or communities, and also with occurrences in time, either phases that things go through or changes, processes that change things, actions, and other kinds of occurrences. Finally, we deal with valorizations from many different sources, from scientific or technical, community, etc. Representations of various kinds, either linguistic or visual, and other accessory concepts such as locations or meshes. Right. All this is not too important, because representing the world is necessary, but what is more important is how we're doing it under the hood. And I will give you a couple of examples of how expressive we are being in CHARM by using ConML. Here you can see a very simplified example of some situation related to cultural heritage. In this diagram, you can see things that you are more or less familiar with, I imagine, like and values and attributes and links between objects, etc. I want to point out a few things. First of all, some of these objects are qualified according to their existence. So, for instance, I can see that this construction C1, which seems to be a farm, also exists since the 18th century. So I'm qualifying this object temporarily. I can also qualify predications. So, for instance, when I say that the C2 construction contains an object fragment made of bone, I'm saying that this happens on 16th of June 1998. So again, I'm qualifying that link, that relationship with a moment in time. I can also mark up my model with what we call certainty markers. So some things are not certain. I can qualify, for instance, that this intentional object, IO1, on the right-hand side of the diagram, is made of bone, but it's probably made of bone. This plus sign in parentheses means that we are qualifying that statement with a probably certainty marker. This is a text that expresses the same thing as the model. It's a farm in some place, built of some materials, including a castle enclosure, etc., etc. And all these statements I have in my text have been represented and expressed in the previous model with the necessary markers for uncertainty or temporality. In the same manner I'm dealing with temporality, I could deal with subjectivity, so different views, different perspectives on the same thing, multilinguality, etc. I also mentioned tools, and I want to show you very quickly what Bond looks like. Bond is a tool that implements ConML and allows to deal with, to construct and manage models expressing ConML, such as Charm. We can run scripts on the model. We can make some kind of visualization of the models in a quite convenient fashion. And finally, I want to go back to the extension I mentioned before. When we extend Charm, we do it in the following manner. Imagine we have Charm as a basic model, and we want to extend it. We want to make changes to it to make it more precisely adjusted to a specific project. So basically, we can create our own ontology from Charm by extension by doing anything. We can add stuff to Charm. We can add extra things. We can modify existing things. And we can even remove things from Charm where we are not interested in. So the consequence of this is that my own ontology at the end can resemble Charm very little. If I add and modify and remove a lot of things, the resulting ontology can be really different to the beginning model. But I have what we call reinterpretation rules. There is some rules embedded in the language that allow me to reinterpret my own ontology in terms of Charm. And this is done automatically. So at any point, I can see my own ontology as if it was Charm. Of course, I can lose information depending on what I have done during the extension process, but this is the price we pay for extension. All this is orchestrated by ConML, which is the language underpinning this, and the semantics of ConML guarantee that any ontology that has been derived from a base one can be reinterpreted. So let's imagine that we want to use this for dataset interoperability, and the previous speaker gave a very good example of this. Imagine we start with two different datasets. They don't share much. They don't share much information. They don't share a common ontology at all. So what we can do to interoperate these data sets is we can build two models, one that describes the data set, the first one that describes the second one, and these models, we can create them as extensions of Charm. So rather than mapping the data sets to the ontology, we create these intermediate models. And these models can be, as I said before, reinterpreted as Charm. This means that I can very easily compare or integrate information from one data set and the other by going through these models as reinterpreted through Charm. Okay, this is very good, but this is really interesting when we go beyond two data sets and use intermediate models. Let's imagine that I have two models in my own organization. They are different. But there is also some data sets in a different organization that is even more different to mine. I can create an intermediate model in my organization that captures everything that is common to the way we work. And of course, I can use reinterpretation to go up or down the model hierarchy as much as necessary. So for instance, if I wanted to compare the models in my own organization, or if I wanted to integrate data from them, I don't need to use Charm at all. I can go through my type model only. However, when I need to integrate my stuff with other organizations, then I can go one level up and go across Charm. So in this way, I can refine the model more or less in a hierarchy as much or as little I need, and I can reinterpret my information more or less according to the needs and according to what I need to compare it with. Okay, and I'll give you some conclusions now. I started by saying that ontologies have a dual heritage. So we have artificial intelligence on the one hand, sovereign data on the other, and we have seen how interesting aspects of both can be combined for a better perspective. I also emphasize the idea that we need to think about people, but also machines when developing ontologies. And I also mentioned some tools that we can use to create models for the people that can also be computed and reasoned about by machines. I also emphasize the idea of well-defined languages with formal support that allow us to bridge this gap between people and machines. So the issue here is that we can build some models that are useful for both communities, for the people and also for the machines, without any need to implement those models in a different language. I also said that we need to focus on the domain and try to remove implementation noise. Implementation noise is necessary, but only when implementing. And we will create in the ontology, when we create the description of the domain in a formal language, we should focus on the domain and remove as much noise as possible. I also emphasize the idea of using aspects to deal with cross-cutting concerns, such as objectivity, temporality, vagueness, etc. And of course, I emphasize the idea of managing model ecosystems, or models at different abstraction levels that we can reinterpret as necessary when we deal with different data sets. Everything I've said is more or less described in this book. That adds a lot of detail, of course, but I recommend it as a good source, especially if you need an introductory text for conceptual modeling in archaeology and other disciplines related to cultural heritage. And this is everything from me. Thank you very much, and I'll be very happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, César, for your talk. Yeah, indeed, there is a question from Beatrice Markov. If Beatrice, if you want to ask you the question by yourself.
Do you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you for this presentation. I would like to know the relationship between the what you call reinterpretation rule and simple mappings between ontologies. What reinterpretation rule have in our special with respect to mappings between ontologies?
Okay, the answer is quite simple. Reinterpretation rules assume that instead of keeping track of every change you make to the model in order to create your own particular version of it, we give the user total freedom. So you don't need to keep track of every change. You can change your base model as you please. Reinterpretation rules then take the base model on the one hand and the final model on the other and allow you to reconcile both. So basically they explore the structure of both models and using some intelligence, so to speak, about the way models are constructed, they allow you to see any instance of the base of the resulting model as if it was an instance of the base model. Of course, as I said, this usually involves some loss of information. For instance, if you have added detail to the model in the process of extension, when you reinterpret your data, then you will lose all the details. You will see the same data, but it will be more abstract. This is a necessary consequence. On the other hand, if you have removed information in the extension process, the reinterpretation rules will create some unknown values to fill in the necessary slots, so to speak. So in a nutshell, the difference is that instead of a guided process that keeps track of the changes, we give total freedom to make changes, and then we reinterpret after the fact. That is basically the difference. I don't know if I've helped you with my answer.
Yes, I understand the purpose of those rules, but what form they have? How they are expressed, in fact? This is my question.
Okay, they are expressed formally. When we extend a model, we usually do it with a tool such as BUNT. So in Bunt, there is a modeling engine which allows you to express models, but also that allows you to reconcile different models using these reinterpretation rules. So the rules are hard-coded into the modeling engine. For instance, one of these rules is about subtyping. So if you have added a class that is a subtype of a pre-existing class, any instances of this subtype are going to be reinterpreted as instances of the more general class. This is an informal way to explain it. It can be expressed formally, but the modeling engine enforces this rule and applies it automatically. So it's encoded in the programming of the modeling engine.
Thank you very much.
It's no problem.
Dariana, are there any other questions to Cesar? Otherwise, I had a very short question. I mean, it was very interesting about the fact that you talk about vagueness and the representation of vagueness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's say in the context of cultural heritage, could you make an example of ontological vagueness?
Yes, of course. We distinguish between ontological and epistemic vagueness. Epistemic is related to the fact that we are not sure about things. I'm not sure how all this idea is reached. Ontological vagueness is about things in the world not having very specific boundaries. For instance, a mountain. If I'm sitting at the top of the mountain, I can say I'm in the mountain. If I'm sitting at the bottom of the valley, I can say I'm not in the mountain. But there is not a clear division between the mountain and the valley. There is a gradual transition, right? So the mountain has not ontologically clear boundaries. So that's an example of ontological vagueness.
But in the context of culture or heritage, I mean, did you come to some specific example for, I don't know, like pottery?
Well, I think that the landscape, the physical landscape, is a key component of cultural heritage. So the example of the mountain, I think, works quite well. And I can give you a very good example consequence. Imagine that we need to protect a site because it's especially valuable for a community. Where do we put the boundaries?
Yes.
Do we put them here or here or here? So establishing the boundaries of a protection perimeter is something that is not trivial because the landscape has fuzzy boundaries, there is some vagueness there. Yeah.
Yes, I understand. And this is also very relevant for natural heritage, right?
Of course it is, yes.
Landscape. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I found the presentation very interesting also because you didn't discuss, I mean, this is actually like the second presentation or the third presentation here in the conference where we didn't address only reference to semantic web technologies. And again, I mean, in my opinion, this is good in the sense that we really open the spectrum of multiple approaches and multiple technologies to manage our data, right? Like semantic web is one approach, but it's not the unique approach or the only approach that we have nowadays available.
Of course,
it's,
yes.
It's very good, I mean, that we bring this on the table, in my opinion. I had some comments in the Google Doc, so if you want to answer to some of the questions, please feel free to do that.
Okay, yeah,
that
sure.
Everyone can look at them.
Yeah.
Are there any other comments, questions to Cesar?